Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I will be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado, to today's episode. The idea of an entrepreneur giving up a good job in order to pursue their own venture is hardly an isolated one, but few entrepreneurs would believe their journey could take 20 years, seeing off a dot-com crash, two terrorist attacks on either side of the Atlantic, and a global financial crisis, any one of which could have brought many SMEs down. But that's exactly what today's guest did. In 1998, Michael Dwyer sketched out the basis for his new venture on the front of an Irish independent newspaper on a flight back from London that would see him quit a marketing director's role with Northern Foods to develop a hub on the internet to bring brands and consumers together in a way that works for both, using offers as a key attraction. And with that, pigsback.com was born. What followed were thousands of squeezy pink pig stress relievers, multiple ups and downs that saw the business skirt perilously close to oblivion, and further fundraisers, harsh cost-cutting plans, illogical price from competitors, which proved to be their undoing, before finally he sold the business in April 2019 to Secret Escapes for a rumoured 25 million. I won't ask him about that one. But anyway, Michael, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aidan. Delighted to be here.
Good, good. Right. Without giving away all of the good stuff from your book, which I have read, but we want people to go out and buy it anyway, right? I'm sure you want people to, definitely want people to buy it. So, but let's talk about the origins of pigsback.com. And I suppose, what made the concept unique back in 1999 when you started it?
Yeah, I remember I had spent 15 years, as you alluded to in the introduction, in the FMCG space. So, you know, first job was with Jacobs Foods for about 6 years. They were bought by Danone, went to them in France for about 3 years, London for a period, back to Green Isle Foods. So, but I was always probably, I was always thinking, oh, I'm getting very good experience here. I have to hang in, you know, or I'm earning a few quid here. It's no harm, you know. But there was probably always an entrepreneur in me. But as I, in my role as Group Marketing Director of Green Isle Foods, part of Northern Foods, that's the company of the Goodfellas pizza brand and Donegal Catch, among other brands, I was tasked with looking at this new thing called the internet and, you know, what relevance it might have for Goodfellas Pizza, which was our biggest brand. And I remember just finding it a complete head scratcher. At the time, there were a lot of brands doing these big pop-ups, you know. Internet quality was very, very poor. You probably remember the old narrow band hissy stuff, you know, the and, you know, it was very, very poor. So anybody who attempted to interrupt you in your efforts to even download a site, you know, or do anything with higher quality media was very, very unwelcome. So I certainly didn't like that. There was a lot of talk even in those days about spam. So, you know, email maybe that we hadn't signed up for, but that we were getting too frequently and it was untargeted, et cetera, et cetera. Then I read an author called Seth Godin on the subject of permission marketing, his book, Permission Marketing. It was 1999. And I was very taken by what he had to say. So he laid out a path forward, which he called permission marketing. And I suppose it was the antithesis of this interruption marketing. It basically said, we need to establish a two-way contract, something that's very transparent. I know as the consumer where I stand and the brand knows where it stands. And the idea was that I commit by giving a certain amount of data, by signing up maybe to receive a new newsletter at a known frequency. And in return, the brand says to me, they will pay attention to the data that I've given, they'll send me relevant information, and they'll never, ever rent or sell my data. So I thought, this permission marketing, that's great stuff. So I thought about it for a while. And eventually, on this flight back from London, the kind of light bulb moment where I said, maybe we could be that curator or gatekeeper, at the time I called it, between brands and consumers. So I suppose it was the first, maybe one of the first ideas for a marketplace, certainly in Ireland, you know, but it would be a marketplace between brands and consumers, consumers are very interested in brands. We spend all our money on brands, you know, whether they be consumer goods, services, holidays, whatever it is, you know. So why not create a place on the internet where brands and consumers could meet with us as the curator, and we'd ensure that what came from the brands to the consumers came via us and was relevant. But not just relevant, it gave them a benefit. So the obvious benefit to start with was a special offer. Okay. And that's how it started.
You had looked at other ideas, and in the book you say to yourself that, that you didn't go for them because you didn't think you were bringing something to it. In you were bringing a skill set yourself to it. So what do you think you were bringing to pigsback.com that you weren't maybe bringing to those other ideas that you kind of had?
I mean, for, if somebody came to me with a marketplace idea today, you know, in my sort of capacity as an angel investor or whatever, I would run a mile. I wouldn't invest. You know, I'd warn them against the complexity of it. I didn't understand those things. Because there were two dimensions to it. One was the B2B and the other was the B2C. So the B2C, I felt I understood, and to this day I'd stand over that. I think that was my area of expertise, you know. The B2B, I wasn't that afraid of because I felt I understood the marketing managers, the marketing executives that we were selling to. I felt I understood their need. And that too turned out to be the case. Now, you know, a lot of other complexities come along to sort of muddy the waters, but I think that's probably where I stood. I felt I had something to contribute to both the B2C and the B2B head.
And when you started, what did you think success would look like, and how did you think your business was going to make money, I suppose, as well?
Yeah, no.
Because they're two different things, really.
Well, you remember it, Aidan. I mean, it was crazy times. .com, I didn't know it was a bubble. But I knew it was a dot-com craze. Mm-hmm. I knew, like, there was, you know, crazy amounts of money making its way into this whole area. I really believed in the technology and the communications power of the internet and that it really would transform things. Like, it's very easy to say that now, but I really did believe that. It wasn't hard to see. Mm. You know, already we were all using email. That was something that was adopted, you know. So all the naysayers, all the will never catch on characters, they were still using email, yeah. You know. And it was fairly obvious that, you know, just even from basic sites, companies were gravitating towards the internet, and there were some companies already that were making real inroads in what they were doing. I guess I wanted a part of that, a part of this new wave. I had put off and off and off the time to launch my own business. I always found another excuse. Oh, I have an opportunity to go to France. Oh gosh, I'm getting a nice promotion here with this job. Oh look, you know, one thing and another. And eventually I had achieved a fair bit in the corporate space. I was probably quite young for where I was at, and I didn't want that to be the rest of my life. So in comes this wave of change, and within that I could see opportunity. So that certainly was the draw, that I could get in on this, I could raise money on the back of this, and hopefully I could, you know, make quite a mark for myself fairly quickly. And quite frankly, I probably envisaged selling the business within a small few years. Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't expect it to be a 20-year journey. So, yeah, it was an opportunity to be involved and probably an opportunity to raise money and make a mark and make money fairly quickly.
And, you know, I mentioned, obviously, there was a few global crises along the way. You know, you had the dot-com bust, then you had 9/11. But if you take them aside, you think in terms of the concept itself that you maybe started the business, the company, a couple of years too early. Were you just too far, too early in for the market at that stage?
When you think back on it, 15%. Internet in Ireland, household penetration of internet. So like, what's that, roughly 1 in 7 homes had internet. So it was ridiculously early, and it was narrow band internet. But at the same time, among entrepreneurs, there was a sense of this land grab that we had to go out there and do it. Early and all as we were, that really the investment monies were there to carry you through this early phase, and the market would eventually come and you'd be there and you'd own the market, you know. So that's the way we thought of it. But I realized very, very quickly that e-commerce wasn't happening. And consequently, the revenues we would gain would have to be exclusively the fees we charge brands to be involved. That would change and turn on its head completely 10 to 15 years later. But at that early stage, we had no option but to go after brands and create these marketing and advertising products for them. I mean, it started with the most basic competition. It was a revelation to us. We created a competition. We might have had, at the time, 30,000 members, say, but 10,000 of them would enter the competition. There were absolutely phenomenal levels of engagement. So on the back of a competition, with the competition as a core element, if you like, we built these interactive features for brands. So we might put a survey around it. We might put a poll. We might put a coupon for the product. I remember at one point Sunsilk coming to us and going, look, we see you're building the female audience online. We're struggling to get any engagement ourselves. What do you propose? And the team went off and thought about it. And they came back and they said, how about we get people to write poems about their hair experiences, their bad hair days, their good hair days, all of this kind of thing. But like we literally had, I'm guessing this was 2002 or three, we literally had 5,000 poems submitted to us, which was a phenomenal level of engagement. Now, some were just, you know, a little limerick or a bit of fun, but there were some massive efforts that were fantastic because people were highly engaged with the subject. They became highly engaged with the brand as a result. And of course, we were able to deliver that engagement. So we were able to, you know, command very significant fees. You know, campaigns like that could range from 20 to 50,000, you know.
Big money for a startup company.
Yeah, exactly. Now, we weren't getting that in year one or year two. Year one and year two were very, very difficult. But by year two and a half, I think we hit our first month of break even. That was very exciting. And I'm pretty sure it was 2002 was a break even year for us. And we started then to consider growth elsewhere.
I suppose, and I've talked to a lot of entrepreneurs, when they typically set up a business, they have an awful lot of hats to wear. They have the finance, the marketing, the idea, the organization, all of that type of thing. And I think many of them try to do all of those jobs themselves, right? Or too many of them try to do all of that. You almost went the opposite extreme in that you kind of brought in an awful lot of very skilled people, you know, dedicated skilled people from the very, very start. I suppose, given when you look back in it and the cost cutting that had to come through and everything, do you think that was a mistake that you made? You overexposed in terms, because the cash was there and you kind of went, oh, we'll get. And maybe it goes back to that idea that you said, we weren't planning to be around for 20 years, Aidan. We wanted to be left out.
It's a really good question. I mean, I guess I was bringing a big company approach, you know, you know, my wife and I kind of, you know, emptied our own pockets to get the thing going, and we made a fairly substantial upfront investment. But I was able to raise about, what was it, 1.5 million punts, so 1.8 million euros, you know, now some of it in services. So I was able to raise the money to do what we needed to do. And like we did get on the back of that money to break even, but the initial plan was to refund it after 6 months. Of course, the dot-com bubble then burst so we had to adjust. But, you know, nobody was overpaid. People were all part of the equity. I don't regret that. Now, what I do regret is when we had to pull things right back from a peak of 100 people, 20 in Canada, 40 in the UK, 40 in Ireland, sorry, not 4, 20 in the UK and 60 in Ireland, something around that. We pulled it right back. And at one point, I found myself just doing too many jobs. I was commercial director in the UK. I was commercial director in Ireland. I wasn't, but I was acting. You know, I was too involved in the day-to-day finances, just making sure that the cash flows were right. And we were, you know, like I had very, very good people beside me still, but, you know, there were a small number of us and I had myself spread too thinly. And that was the point in the business where I was doing I was doing my poorest job. I was at my weakest. And it wasn't till I kind of gave myself elevation again and learned really to work on the business rather than in the business all the time. That was a massive, massive turning point. I laugh at my daughter. I've three daughters, but two of the girls have set up an online fashion rental business called Droby, you know. But she was quoted in a recent article as saying, I got a piece of advice from my dad, which was to try to work on the business rather than in the business. I said to myself, Nikki, that was meant to be like in a few years' time, not straight away. But she's doing a damn good job at it anyway.
The From a very early stage, you and your kind of your marketing committee agreed on and kind of committed to a set of values for the brand, right? And the company. How important do you think for pigsback.com, but as a general comment, it is to have that clarity of purpose when you're setting up a business?
Do you know, I think it's very important. You know, like we all prefer to have a sense of mission about us. You know, missionaries are way better than mercenaries, you know. So, I was certainly a missionary, but many, many of the people around me were too, you know, as in they were very excited to be part of this whole new wave, which was the internet. There weren't that many startup.coms in Ireland. So to be part of them, you know, despite the woes that they knew we were having at many, many times, they felt privileged to be in that and to be getting that experience. And many of them went on to do some very, very big things, which we might come to later on. But so I think having that clarity was certainly important. But somehow or other, you know, it's very easy to sort of put the old values on the wall. And like most companies' values are the same. Like we're all trying to sort of do a good job, you know.
Not leg over the customer.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, you'll very quickly get to trust, quality, do what we say we'll do, reliability, you know, all of those things. You know, in our case, you know, ease of use, empathy, those kind of things. But how the hell do you summarize that in a way that's meaningful? And we made various efforts at the start. And I think the brand kind of with all its pinkness and its whatever, it sort of expressed itself. But actually, when we nailed it was later on when we, you know, came into the daily deals market and were competing in an overcrowded space. And I remember us going away to the Hudson Bay Hotel in Athlone, and we got together and we were all talking about our values. Do we need to reset anything? Is everything good? And I said to the guys, what distinguishes us? And we talked about our competitors and the fact that some had let a number of maybe hotels down. A hotel manager overexposed himself to an offer, or some restaurant gave some silly deal away, and you know the site that was publishing that deal was not available for contact. So the poor guys were you know, we said we wouldn't do that type of thing. So we decided that what distinguished us very simply was we give a shit. And we put that up on the wall big and bold. So in everything we do, whether it's our care of the customer, dealing with the problems that they have, you know, be the customer, the merchant, let's call it the hotel or the restaurant or whatever, or be it the punter who's just bought the offer and has a problem or has a problem with their account or whatever, we give a shit. Mm-hmm. We're going to really dig in and sort that problem out. We as a company, we give a shit about you, our employees. We'll pay attention to the things that are bothering you. We'll try to improve things as we realistically can as we go. And on we march together. And I think that was probably the best piece of internal branding that we did.
It's amazing, isn't it? The you mentioned in, the other thing about, you know, in terms of from the early stage, you had an awful lot of people who were equity owners within it. And I always think, you know, if you want somebody to act like an owner of a business, you have to make them an owner of the business in terms of having skin in the game, you know, and I'm not sure that a lot of entrepreneurs necessarily buy into that. You know, where are you on it?
I'm very, very, very strongly in that camp. Yeah. Very, very strongly in that camp. Now, you know, remember at the beginning we had these share options that sort of everybody was aware they had share options, but I think people doubted their value, and they were right to doubt their value. They had very little value, and that turned out to be the case. But around 2015, it was a key moment. It was kind of, would we have the energy to go on, or would we, you know, could we go again was the big question that I had. And I remember coming up with a project which I called Project Encore, which was one last chance. Needless to say, I was still full of my optimism. Mm-hmm. People were kind of the eyes to the air, I'm sure, behind me, go, there he goes again, full of his optimism. But I spoke to, in particular, my four key managers, and I said, look, guys, you know, are you guys prepared to commit for one real, real go at this again, you know? And I approached our shareholders and I said, you know, we need to give these guys some serious equity. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to reward them for their forbearance. We need to reward them for their commitment. And we need to incentivize them that if the day comes that we get this unlikely turnaround, that they are going to feel well about it. And not just them, but everybody else in the company. Now, they really understood that and they bought into that. And that was transformative without any doubt. You know, the level of commitment, their way of thinking. You know, we might be having a board meeting or a management meeting, and somebody would say, "Look, if we make that change, it could be worth 50,000 a year." And the question would be asked then, well, what would that do to our value? Well, 50,000 at 10 times simplistically is 500,000 on the value. Okay, well, you guys between you, you own 5% or whatever it is, or 10%, you know, so that's 50 grand's worth of value to you guys. You know, we never framed our questions and answers in that way before. And it really meant something to them. You could see the eyes open up and the little sparkle appearing, and off people went and they made sure that happened.
And do you think, as another question I have, do you think that Project Encore was the sliding door moment for that business, that it could easily have been gone, or it kind of set itself up for, you know, the path where it ultimately, you did have success in that it was bought out and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, you'll often, we're all familiar with the phrase, the darkest hour is just before the dawn. But, you know, we don't necessarily know that, you know, so as people or as companies. But on September the 11th, let me get this right, 2014, I remember walking around City West Business Park where we were with John McDonald, Johnny Mack, my right-hand man, my number two, who played a huge, huge role in the company all the way along and runs the company to this day, which is fantastic. But, you know, we were really wondering if it was, John in particular was kind of going, oh, I wonder, are we just, is there just too much coming at us? Is there too much kind of creditor pressure, cash pressure, competitive pressure? People, you know, the market was overcrowded. Somebody by this point surely would have blinked, but they hadn't. Mm. We didn't think we'd be first. I didn't want to be first. And, you know, John's energies were low at the time. Now, he recovered his energies in no uncertain terms later on as my energies dissipated. But on that particular day and over that period, my energies were still good. And I rallied the team, got them together, and we discussed a few measures that we could take. And we came up with, as a result, Project Encore, and on we went. So could it have gone either way? Look, I'm going to say no, because I always believed. Mm-hmm. But, you know, realistically, yes, it could.
But I suppose, at a different time, if your energies hadn't have been, you know, a few months later when your energy wasn't as high, if it happened to coincide with Johnny Mack's energies not being high, it could have easily...
Well, that's it. No, absolutely, yeah. I mean, 5 years later, I was done. Yeah. Absolutely done. You know, the final year of the business, the exit process obviously kept me focused. But that brings its own stresses. And, you know, for the year subsequent to the sale, I was absolutely done, you know, exhausted, and just trying to basically recover my energies and, to a certain extent, recover my head.
And switching, because there's another interesting thing when you talk about, given the long tenure that the company had, you know, and the various different ups and downs that there were, how important is it, or how do you manage your board and your investors when those things aren't going well? And then also, I suppose, having read the book, you know, probably one of your biggest difficulties was trying to manage that urge to exit by others when you wanted to keep, you know, keep going. So
that became a royal pain in the ass. I mean, yeah, you know, Kevin, our chairman, an Englishman, who was introduced to me by my brother back in 2001 or two. He entered the business at that point. He became our chairman, you know, and Kevin is a very, very good friend. But I was worn out listening and telling me, Michael, isn't it time we exited? You know, I'm going, there is nothing to exit, you know. You know, we were just not, it was frustrating. It's not the answer I wanted to give him, but it was very realistically the answer. And within Project Encore, it was also my saying, I do not want mention of that four-letter word, EXIT, until I bring it back into the equation, because it's tiring us all out. There's no point. Let's concentrate on the business. Let's concentrate on the process. Let's build value. And if and when that time comes, I'll flag it. But please, between now and then, don't give us the negative energy of that word when it doesn't belong in the business, because we're not at that point. But like, he was absolutely within his rights. Mm. And, you know, that sort of pressure on us was in many ways no harm, but it was becoming a bit wearing on our energies. Mm. Overall, I would say, just in terms of managing shareholders, like, you know, we can write whatever business plans we want. Paper takes ink. Mm-hmm. You know, we can dot I's and we can cross T's, but we don't control the uncontrollables. We don't control the dot-com crash. We don't control the credit crunch. Mm. You know, we don't control 9/11. We don't control these things. And when they happen to a business, I think it's, you know, it's just time to step back, take stock, be realistic, hide nothing, be really, really transparent and honest about it, and just call things as they are. Because, people sense bullshit a mile away. Mm. They sense honesty too. And they sense real endeavor and integrity in that endeavor too.
But it also helps if they're aligned with the concept of the business from the start too, that you know, because there's always going to be stuff that buffets them, but if they actually think it's a genuinely good idea at the very start when they invest.
You see, I'm not sure about that, Aidan. Right. And like, I think the tide goes in and out for investors, and you know this better than anyone, so it'll be interesting to hear what you take of this view. I think late 99, 2000, the whole dot-com wave got me and got a lot of our investors very excited, too excited, me and the investors. And when that tide went out, a lot of people, I think, a lot of those investors would have been saying to themselves, how did I get caught up in this? And it's a question I could have asked of myself, but I was in it and, you know, I was staying in it and I was going to find some damn way to make it work out. So I think a lot would have regretted their investment very, very quickly. Not that they didn't believe in me or believe in the idea, but I think that was secondary to the fact that the tide was in.
Yeah.
And they were carried away in that wave of sentiment. So I think that sort of softer friends and family kind of money is very tidal dependent. I don't know. I think some really were more in it for tidal movements than they were for, you know, the great idea or the great man that Michael was. I mean, proof of the pudding there is that our second round of funding, having raised 1.8 million from our original investors, we got a sum total of 18,000 euros from about 2 million fundraise from those investors in the second round. I don't blame them one iota. It is what it is. And many came back in subsequent rounds, you know, again, as things were a bit better again and rejoined, but we managed to sustain the valuation at that point. And, you know, they felt probably, well, there's no particular need in that case to invest. But we got 3,000 euros from one investor. And I think my brother put in about 15,000 euros, which was very important. And my wife and I had to put some money in as well, just to be seen to follow, you know.
Switching from investors, I suppose, to the other stakeholders in all of this are always the staff. And where are you on the hire in or develop from inside?
Oh, I'm a big time grow your own. Big time, you know. And like, you know, when you get, say, a very good account director, you know, maybe a junior commercial director or somebody who has the capacity to be a commercial director. But isn't that, you know, at that time, you know, those people were probably worth 70 to 100,000. You know, today it could be twice that. I've no idea. But we couldn't afford to go out into the market and compete and pay for that. And then there's always a danger you get it wrong, you know. So we much prefer taking people in as maybe account executives or account managers. And fairly quickly, we'd bring them through the ranks because it was very much in our interest to bring them through the ranks. But the whole organization gets excited by seeing people who are dynamically progressing through the ranks because they know it could be them next. So very much grow our own. And, you know, we talked about the whole missionary thing earlier on. You know, they were bought into the story. They were bought into the company. They were bought into our mission. And they knew our ways. They knew our culture. We knew they represented us very well. So, that's always been my way.
There is, I'm almost sure, there's definitely a part in the book we talk about, you know, there was from time to time some people that were employed that, you know, they were brilliant at what they did, and the question is, do you let them continue? But the downside was this kind of collateral damage in the way they do it and things like that. So that decision to, you know, keep somebody who's brilliant and not quite ignore the downside, but just have to put up with the downside of those brilliant people?
Yeah, it's very, very tricky, isn't it? I think the expression is, isn't it? Excuse me, that there's no I in team, you know, and there isn't. And those people who I describe as being all elbows, you know, they are corrosive. There's no doubt to the sort of, you know, the team environment. I used to try to find fixes where I'd say somebody like that, look, they're almost entrepreneurial. So let's call them intrapreneurs. Entrepreneurs. So if I can put them almost in a cell on their own, you know, or give them a business unit to develop
them
and run,
you
know, that might work well. But otherwise, to sort of, you know, have them too integrated with the rest of the team, well, they wouldn't integrate, and it would be, as I said, corrosive and wouldn't work. So my conclusion in the end was it just wasn't worth it.
The when you look back over the years, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you?
Massive. No, you nailed that one. yeah, well, I mean, like, it was the only show in town for me. It was an all-in bet, you know, in poker parlance. And I think more, like, I would really stress to entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs these days, like, don't think like I thought then. Please don't. It's not the only show in town, you know. It's okay to fail and to fail early. In fact, it's a good thing to fail. You know, somebody who's learned a lot from a previous venture or, you know, any previous initiative that failed and is able to talk about that and talk about what they've learned and how they're applying that now in what they're doing, they're always more investable. But I kind of didn't see it that way. And the longer I went on with that attitude, the harder it became.
You're getting ingrained in it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually stupidly kind of got this view in my head that I was unemployable, you know, and that I couldn't muster the energies to go back into employment if that ever happened to me. So I had to make this succeed.
Switching tack slightly, you know, given the times that the company lived through, right, it's not surprising that you had difficulties dealing with the banks here and abroad, but do you think it's a drawback that there's no real venture banks in Ireland? Now, notwithstanding, obviously, what we've seen with SVB and this report, that whole idea of a bank that is more geared to taking development or venture risk.
Yeah, I mean, I look at what's available to startups these days and, you know, I go, wow, that's wonderful compared to what was available. There was nothing. You know, there was certainly going to be no bank finance. If the tide was in, yes, there was, you know, there was some seed funding available around the place.
You always get the umbrella when the sun is shining, you know that.
Exactly, yeah. But you know yourself, I mean, venture, there are far more venture capital companies now than there were then. And there are also some who are very actively looking at startups. You know, there are podcasts for startups, you know, where like your own, like several others that are looking at the whole area of, you know, the development and scaling of businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So the resources are superb. I think it's a very good idea. I think there probably is scope, but I can't imagine them throwing too many overdrafts at startups, that said. But I can imagine them having a very keen interest in businesses that are scaling well and attracting a lot of investment. You know, what difference is that going to make to the company? I'm not so sure. The more important thing is the availability of capital through whatever means. And you know, there's a lot of good EIS stuff going on. There was then too, you know, in my time too. Funny, at the other end of it, I mentioned this to somebody recently. There's a company I've recently invested in that's just come through a SCARP program. That SCARP, so the which is the administration process for small companies who are viable but are carrying legacy baggage with them, and, you know, baggage that they must really shed if they're to succeed in the future and have a fair chance. I think that's a really, really good development. It would have been an option for us. Would I have done it? I doubt it, but...
But it would have been nice to have the option.
It would have been nice to have the option, you know, whereas really those restructuring options that were available, the formal restructuring options were fairly draconian. So we had to settle for an informal restructuring option. So I think there are a lot of very, very good things going on in the environment. But, you know, I guess at the same time, you know, startups have become sexy and very alluring. And there is this temptation, I think, on the part of young people maybe to think that it's an easy route to stardom and, you know, easy money and whatever not. And, you know, we know it's not like that. So the book, to a certain extent, sorry not to be plugging the book, but, you know, any message I would give to anybody in that fear is, look, do... Just please, please realize that this is going to be very, very tough. And, you know, very often you see really high quality individuals in front of you, you know, and, you know, I trust you will be able to adapt and your team will be able to adapt, but you will have to adapt and it's going to be incredibly tough. And the other thing I say to them is your partner on board with this? Does your partner realize what is about to sort of, you know, come your way, you know, and you know, it's not in the business plan because you haven't written a credit crunch into your business plan and you haven't written a dot-com crash or whatever the hell it's going to be next, because there will be something next. There's a banana skin around the corner, that's for sure, you know. So it's very, very, I was very lucky, very, very lucky that my wife, Karen, understood business. She didn't allow me bring my problems home and overindulge them. She kept a great perspective, you know, so it meant that when I came home, it was about the kids and it was about the family. And sure, the cloud was there with me. But, you know, in switching into the kids, that really helped me. And
it didn't dictate all of your life. There was still a part.
And it could. It could become all absorbing, you know. And like, you know, I've been reading more and more about this. Just so, you know, I suppose in the context of the book and since I've left the business. But entrepreneurs are a bit tapped. You know, like we have to be to do what we do, you know. And very often you'll find a higher incidence of mental illnesses. You'll find a higher incidence of behavioral disorders like ADHD, et cetera, stress, addiction disorders, all those sort of things. Like they're fairly high in the population, but they're very high among the entrepreneurial population. But you'll also find, sadly, at an extreme end, a higher suicide rate. Some people who just take it too far and can't get beyond it. And, you know, it's just terribly, terribly, terribly sad. But I think we understand how that can happen. I would hope that it wouldn't and would hope that people would have context. But I know how people can get so absorbed in these things. There's a higher rate of marital breakdown.
So you better make sure your partner is signed on.
Guess what? You know, there's no surprise in that either. Yeah. You know?
Well, it's funny. We've interviewed Farrell Harrington and Rena Maycock, and they're a husband and wife entrepreneur. So that's the real thing, you know? There's no break there. Switching to the final act, if you will. How did you know it was the right time to sell? And was it about the business or was it more about you?
Yeah, it was a bit of both. I certainly was coming to the end of my energies for the business, and you know, having been through to so much, you know, we got a great run from Project Encore on. We got a great run. It took us about. Within a year of us doing Project Encore, one of our major competitors did blink, grab one part of the independent group, and they folded. But a couple of the other competitors we were talking to, you know, I really strongly recommend this to any entrepreneur listening. Talk to your competitors, you know, talk to them. They will talk. They want to talk to you. You know, they may not realize it, but they do. And you'll end up having a far more open conversation than you realize. But that became very, very valuable for me, because as a couple of the smaller players within the market realized that they weren't going to be the big winners, they were open to a conversation about an exit. Now, we had very, very little money, but one thing we did do that worked out extremely well for us, but also for the guy on the other side of the deal, was we sold our empathy research business. So we had developed these alternative strands of income to keep us going through the troubled times. One of them was an online market research business called Empathy Research. Its manager, Declan O'Reilly, I put it to him just after that famous 9/11 walk around City West. I said, Declan, would you consider would you consider seeking finance to buy the business? And he said, yeah, no, I absolutely would. He was very excited. And thankfully, he actually got bank finance for it, as well as his own, you know, funds and family funds and whatever. whatever not. He's done very well with it since. But that 500-ish thousand euros made such a difference to us. Gave us working capital, but it also gave us the ability to look at a couple of the very small players in the market. So the first one we bought was Deal Rush. And I remember, like, you know, hesitating and going back and pushing it out. And we did a deal that was, you know, there was a certain amount up front and there was a certain amount later. It ended up being an absolute slam dunk of a deal that paid for itself within months because we executed the bolt-on really well. Our CTO, Paul Finnegan, I call him the magician, marvellous guy. He had the Deal Rush site ready to go on our platform. So we were able to feed in our own offers, as well as any specific offers they had, our own goods content, so the stuff that you buy that gets delivered in the post, which Deal Rush didn't have. And overnight, I think we certainly added 50% of their sales, got the full gross margin with no added overhead. So we took that model to the to our second purchase, which was escapes.ie, which I bought from James Donnelly, an Australian guy. Himself and his wife ran the business in Ireland. James is a tougher guy to deal with. He held out
no
for a
relation
good price.
To me, folks, just to let you know.
But he was a super guy. We did a deal, and you know, it took a little bit longer to pay back, but it worked really, really well and paid back for us very well. So what happened was, in a pretty short period of time, we had gone from 7 million in gross sales to 27 million in gross sales. And the margin was falling right down to the bottom because we didn't allow the overhead come back up to the levels it had previously been at. Now, I sensed that we were winning the market. I didn't sense. It was fairly obvious to anybody looking at it with any clarity that we were winning the market through organic growth and through acquisition rather than, you know, winning extra sales through market growth. Mm. The market was not growing, but we were winning share through organic growth, organic share gains, and through acquisition. So that was sort of the sign to me, look, you've done very well. You've had a great run at it here. God knows what's around the corner. So just be open to what might come. And, you know, good fortune shone on us then when I got an email out of the blue from Jean-Charles Lacoste. Mm. And I actually binned the email, Aidan. I said, oh, no, this is some spam email. And I said, get back here, you. Back into the email.
Just have a look.
And I rang the guy straight away. He was from Secret Escapes. And they had an interest in looking at a commercial partnership where, you know, we might take some of their premium, you know, in particular continental travel packages, and they would take our premium Irish hotel packages, and that would make sense for both parties. So we spoke, and at the end of the conversation, he said to me, he says, Michael, would Big's Back consider selling to Secret Escapes? And I gave him the right answer, which was no. But we did agree to meet, and we met 2 weeks later, and that was the start of the process. And one other large company that I'd been talking to in the UK, they were a competitor of ours in Ireland, but they were a much bigger player than that in a UK context. They were interested in us as well, and you know,
always good to have two bidders.
Essential, yeah. Absolutely essential. You know, one kept the other honest, and you know, we got a fair price. Yeah. We got a very fair price in the end, so we're very, very lucky.
Looking back, though, on the journey, I asked you at the start, how did you think you would measure success? Looking back on the journey, how do you measure success? Is it money? Is it the knowledge? Is it the creativity? Is it experience that you've gained over the 20 years?
It's not the money. Money is great. Mm. Money is great. It gives us, you know, security and, for me, probably the luxury of controlling my own time, but it's not the money. I got great satisfaction out of seeing my managers and the team doing very well, and I say that very, very sincerely. That meant an awful lot to me, and I know that money meant an awful lot to them. And I think where that isn't the case in an exit, it's wrong. Mm. I think that should be the case in an exit, you know, because it's built on the back of the team. Mm. The creative endeavours over all the years, you know, I love that. I am a creative person, probably know way more about myself now than I ever did. I probably was, entrepreneurship is nature and nurture. I think it most definitely is in my nature. So creating is something that gives me great fulfillment. You know, it was probably no wonder I took to writing journals in 2005. You know, and as we kind of came up against one thing or another, well, I had my journals. I could sort of be creating something within that. I could be chatting away to myself. Mm-hmm. It was a good way to unknot problems. But I really enjoyed that pursuit. And actually, you know, the book is not a commercial thing, but the book is something that, for me, is a great reward that I've got from the business and the privilege of being able to devote the time to write it and edit it and work with my editor, Gavin Daly, and, you know, ultimately do the book and do the audiobook. That's been a real privilege too. So I think it's been fulfilling overall, notwithstanding the few challenges along the way.
Just the minor ones. Now, we have a final tradition in this, and it is the final question. I don't know what it is. I'm opening the book here in front of you. All right. Oh, now, I'm going to read out the question, okay? And I'm going to add in a little rider on the back of it, and I'll explain. So the question is, what advice would you give your 25-year-old self, right? And I'm going, my rider is, because your daughter Kerry worked with us in Dave and has now gone to make her fortune in London, would that be the same advice you'd give Kerry, who was about 25, I think, at this stage? So are the two things the same?
I think they're sort of person dependent. In Kerry's case, Kerry's good in a corporate environment and likes it. So I kind of encourage her to go the corporate route and do that. Now, she's entrepreneurial too, but she'd probably know when the time is right. Her two other sisters have gone on the entrepreneurial route, and to the extent that I was given any opinion on the matter, I certainly would have encouraged them to do it sooner rather than later. So I know a fair bit at this point about the very exacting challenges on the entrepreneur. And I think to say to young people, you're not ready yet, is wrong. Mm. I think go do it while you're young. Go make the mistakes while you're young. And you know what? There's a lot of very good advice and mentorship out there from people who, you know, maybe like me, have been through it and have a lot to offer. Now, they might prefer to listen to somebody else but Dad. But, you know, do listen to other people. Do take on board the mentoring that is out there. But go ahead and do it while you're young.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I would just like to thank my guest, Michael Dwyer. Don't forget to like, share and subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.